Sunny skies and 60 degrees in Phoenix. It's 11 o'clock.
Is Phoenix cool, and is the city doing enough to attract and keep members of the so-called creative class? I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now, we'll hear from commentators Robert Pala, Lori Notaro, and Taz Lumens, and find out why they've stayed in Phoenix or left for the Pacific Northwest. Plus, Lindsay Kincaid and Sarah Sullivan will talk about their efforts to reshape Phoenix and emphasize the creativity around the city. Also, Gabrielle Gifford's husband, Mark Kelly, will talk about his wife's recovery and efforts the two are making to modify some gun laws in the U.S. Daniel Hernandez, the young intern credited with helping save Gifford's life in January of 2011, will discuss how it feels to be called a hero. And longtime journalist Jana Boomersbach has turned to a new career writing books for children. Her first is called A Squirrel Story. All of that is next on a special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Christians worldwide are celebrating Christmas with religious services, special meals, and lots of presents. They're also hearing messages of reaching out to others in need and appreciating their loved ones. Britain's Queen Elizabeth's annual message was about the importance of personal reflection.
I myself had cause to reflect this year at Westminster Abbey on my own pledge of service made in that great church on Coronation Day 60 years earlier.
The message was far more severe in the alternative Christmas message broadcast on Britain's Channel 4 TV that mimics the format of the Queen's annual address. It was a message about the dangers of losing one's privacy, delivered by none other than Edward Snowden, the American who illegally exposed the broad scope of spying by the NSA. He referenced Great Britain's George Orwell's warning about the impact of mass surveillance and the dangers posed to future generations.
A child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. They'll never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves, an unrecorded, unanalyzed thought.
The former NSA contractor leaked data about the NSA's activities to the media. He now faces felony charges in the United States. And Snowden is currently living in Russia. Syria is defending its 10-day aerial bombardment of Aleppo after a White House condemnation from Beirut. Stephen Kalin reports Syria accuses the U.S. of holding it to a double standard and ignoring rebel atrocities.
Damascus is holding to the line it's issued since the conflict began, that it's part of the global war on terror, and the U.S. of all countries should understand the extraordinary measures needed to win. It calls Washington a one-eyed pirate that willfully ignores half of what's happening in Syria. While the targets in Aleppo are residential, it says, the people living there are foreign fighters with ties to Al-Qaeda. It urges the U.S. to open its eyes to massacres in towns like Adra, outside Damascus, where radical rebels have killed dozens, perhaps hundreds, of civilians this month alone. The statement came in response to condemnations on Monday by a White House official who called on Syria to stop its indiscriminate bombing campaign that monitors say has killed more than 400 people, mostly civilians. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Kalin in Beirut.
There's been a Christmas Day attack on Christians in Iraq. Two bombs were detonated in predominantly Christian areas of Baghdad. One of the attacks took place near a church during Christmas Mass. Authorities say more than 36 people were killed and nearly 60 others were wounded. All Americans are accounted for. That is the word today from a U.S. embassy official in Afghanistan, following indirect fire on the Kabul compound today. The Taliban say they were behind the attack and that it caused heavy casualties. That has not been confirmed. There were also reports of deadly violence elsewhere in Afghanistan. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. A combination of higher interest rates and new home prices has some home builders worried about a slightly softer market in the Valley. So some are offering other incentives to encourage potential buyers. From Phoenix, KJZZ's Mark Brody reports.
Those other incentives are literally incentives. Jim Belfiore, president of Belfiore Real Estate Consulting in Phoenix, says they include closing cost assistance and credits on upgrades like a pool or stainless steel appliances. He says this spring, builders were offering incentives of 1 to 3% in many communities. Right now, they've jumped to 4 to 7%. But Belfiore says these levels are not unprecedented.
The reality is that incentives are still much lower than they were in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, even 2011. Incentives started decreasing in 2011, and they continued downward to lows of that 1 to 3% range earlier this year when demand was a lot better.
Belfiore says that's a normal level of incentive in a non-distressed market. And if demand continues to grow as expected, he believes builders will go back to that level and stay there for the next 3 to 5 years. Mark Brody, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A Mesa police officer who rescued an 8-year-old girl after she was briefly abducted has given her a holiday gift, a new bicycle. The girl was abducted Sunday while riding her bike near her Mesa apartment complex. Police say she was able to escape within minutes of being forced into a car by a man. She escaped when her abductor crashed his vehicle. Officer Jonathan Appel found the girl running down an alley and rescued her. But as a result of the investigation, the girl's bike was seized. Appel posted on his Facebook page that he felt bad about it, so he took the girl to a store and bought her a new bicycle. He says with a different bike, she can now affix new and happier memories.
KJZZ is supported by the Jewish Tuition Organization, providing need-based scholarships for children to attend Jewish day schools. Details of the private school tax credit and other support information at jtophoenix.org.
We're expecting a high in Phoenix today of 70 degrees. It'll be clear tonight with a low around 45. Sunny and 64 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
This is a special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Merry Christmas. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Today I'll bring you a look back at one of our lighter controversies of 2013, whether it's time to change Phoenix to appeal more to the so-called creative class, or whether the city is fine as is, or at least as fine as it's ever going to be. We'll hear the opinions of Robert Pala, Taz Lumens, Lindsay Kincaid, Sarah Sullivan, and Amy Silverman. Plus, award-winning investigative journalist Jana Boomersbach made quite a career turn this year. She became a children's book author. We'll talk about her book, A Squirrel's Story. We start today's program with two conversations with men who were deeply affected by the January 2011 Tucson shooting. In a few minutes, you'll hear the discussion I had with Daniel Hernandez, who is credited with helping save the life of Gabrielle Giffords. First up is former astronaut Mark Kelly, Giffords' husband. We talked in November when he and Giffords were in Scottsdale for an event called Endeavor to Succeed. Mark, how is your wife doing?
Gabby is doing great. You know, she continues to work really hard on her recovery. She does, you know, speech therapy and occupational and physical therapy. You know, and she takes it very seriously, and she's continuing to improve, and it's coming up on 3 years since she was injured.
The past 2.5 years, people thought of you before that. Successful astronaut. Obviously, you had a lot of courage to try that, but I imagine the last 2.5 years have been a test like you never imagined you'd have.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it turned out that, you know, one of the greatest challenges of my life was not flying in combat or flying into space 4 times, but it was dealing with the aftermath of what happened to Gabby on January 8th of 2011 when she was injured and 6 of her constituents were murdered. And, so I learned a lot from that experience. And I also applied a lot of the lessons I learned along the way, at, you know, as a pilot in the United States Navy and while working at NASA, too. You know, so it's been quite the learning experience. You know, it was a tragic day, I think, in our, you know, country's history. We seem to have, you know, occasionally have some of these days.
I did want to ask you about your efforts and Representative Giffords' efforts when it comes to changing certain aspects of gun legislation. It doesn't seem like much progress has been made on that, despite your efforts. What's your reaction to that? Have you been surprised?
Well, not only despite our efforts, but, you know, despite what happened nearly a year ago when we had 20 first graders murdered in their classrooms. I mean, it's obvious. I think it's obvious to everybody that we have, you know, we have a problem in this country. We've got a much higher rate of death from gun violence than any other industrialized country, on the order of 15 times higher. And, you know, and when you have, you know, 20 first graders die in such a horrific way, you think there would be some sort of national reaction from our leaders in Washington, D.C., and that hasn't happened yet. And we've been working really hard to try to get them to take some positive steps, like passing a bill that would expand background checks to the gun shows and the internet, but we've come short so far. We got kind of close. it's obvious to me that, you know, this is going to take some time, but, you know, I think as a country we'll get there.
Since you've been in the thick of the battle with this, even if, as you said, maybe something will happen in the future, why hasn't it happened now, even as it seems like there's progress?
It's political, right? It's mm-hmm. not, I don't think it's policy. I think it's politics. You know, there's, there's certain organizations that have a lot of influence in Washington, D.C. It has to do with how members of Congress think about their next election. And they didn't build that influence overnight, so it's not going to go away overnight. And, you know, our role, I think, is to provide just an effective counterbalance to allow members of Congress to vote their conscience on this issue. You know, I've talked to some that, you know, their vote doesn't exactly reflect how they feel about it. Unfortunate.
Do you think this will be an important issue in the 2014 congressional races? Are you going to try to make it one?
Well, I think it will be. You know, it hasn't gone away. And, you know, when you see mass shootings at a greater frequency, and you still see a very high death rate from gun violence, unless we take some steps to change, whether it's the procedure for how you get a background check before buying a gun, or who gets entered into the national into criminal background check system, you don't make changes there and make it harder for criminals and the dangerously mentally ill to get a gun, you wouldn't expect those numbers to go down. And as we've seen since Newtown, you know, we've had other mass shootings in Santa Monica and then at the Washington Navy Yard. So if we don't make some changes, it's not going to get, you know, it's not going to go, the problem's just not going to go away. So I think it will be a issue in the 2014 election.
How much do you want mental health to be part of that package? I mean,
It's a huge part of it. You would have thought Congress would have acted, especially on something that, you know, that most people agree on, that, you know, probably not the daily gun violence in this country, which are really the big numbers, but the ones that get the national attention, like Newtown or what happened in Tucson or Aurora, there is always some mental health aspect of those. You know, typically the person is dangerously mentally ill. Often people knew about it. You know, if you get these folks treatment, I think on a lot of these cases, they would have never done, you know, what they did. So, you know, we continue to work with Congress to, you know, try to affect some change there in you know, with mental health. We used to have a pretty good mental health system in this country. You know, I had a former governor of Texas just tell me the other day, told Gabby and I, he was kind of being sarcastic, but he said, you know what the mental health system now is in the state of Texas? He said it's the county jail, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can really do better than that.
Going back briefly to January 8th, 2011, did you ever say, why us? And if so, how did you get past it?
No, I don't do that. You know, Gabby doesn't do that. She looks forward. You know, sometimes bad things happen to good people, and, you know, you can't go back in time, and you just got to do the best to move forward. And, you know, Gabby continues to work really hard to try to, you know, improve the lives of others, you know, whether it's regard to gun violence or, you know, traumatic brain injury, like, you know, this event on Friday is, you know, we're going to be there for the Brain Injury Alliance of Arizona,
right,
which does a lot of great work in not only connecting families to professionals, you know, to help with people that have traumatic brain injury, but also, you know, trying to prevent people from getting traumatic brain injuries and all this other stuff associated with it. It's amazing how many people in this country in their lifetime will suffer a traumatic brain injury. It's millions.
In interviewing people about Alzheimer's disease and progress in that, for example, or even Valley Fever, interviewed a scientist about that last week, the talk is sometimes great progress is made when someone who's in the public eye has something like this happen. Do you think the awful thing that happened in Tucson is actually going to help make huge progress in brain injuries?
Yeah, well, we hope so. I mean, you know, we hope that, you know, this didn't happen to Gabby and Christina Taylor Greene and Judge John Roll and, you know, so many others. You know, I'm talking about the folks that were killed on that day. You know, that this doesn't happen and just nothing positive comes out of it. Something positive needs to. And whether that's educating people and helping them, you know, get treatment for a family member who has traumatic brain injury, or preventing at least some of deaths, you know, from gun violence. I mean, it's you know, the tragedy in itself is awful. But I think what's really tragic is if you don't try to turn it into something positive. And that's what Gabby's trying to do.
My last question for you is the inevitable question, which I have to ask you, of course.
How do you go to the bathroom in space? Is that what you're going to ask me?
No, I was going to. Well, actually, that's much more important. No, I was going to. Are you going to run for office at some point?
You know, Gabby was a politician in our family. I'm not somebody that ever thought I would run for office. I watch, how difficult it is for members of Congress to get things done in Washington. So I don't have a great desire to be, up there as part of that. I mean, in a way, I guess I am a little bit on the outside. I would never say never. I mean, under the right circumstances, if I felt that maybe I was a person that could, contribute in a little bit different way and could be helpful, I would certainly consider it. But it's not something on my to-do list.
Captain Kelly, thanks for the time.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve.
Former astronaut Mark Kelly from an interview we did in November. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On that January day at a Tucson Safeway, then 20-year-old intern Daniel Hernandez placed his bare hands on the left side of Gabrielle Giffords to keep her from losing more blood. Hernandez became an instant celebrity and was identified as a hero. In February, he and I spoke about his book, They Call Me a Hero. Daniel, what do you think of when you see Gabrielle Giffords?
You know, the last 2 years have been really difficult for anyone that knew Congresswoman before January the 8th to see someone who could so quickly and she would be able to string together words so efficiently and so quickly, and they were always very thoughtful. So for her now to be able to not do that and struggle to come up with even simple sentences is really frustrating for her, I can imagine. But for those of us who have known her for a long time, it's really difficult to see the transition. But it's very inspiring to see, A, that she's still alive, and that she has not given up.
Daniel, because of your actions of 2 years ago, a lot of people call you a hero, though you've shied away from that. Can you give me an idea of what heroes you think came out of January 8th, and even just a general definition of how you would define a hero?
Now, for me, I've always believed that a hero is not someone who does something once and then has earned the title. It's someone who instead has made a lifetime commitment to helping others. So whether it's teachers or nurses or doctors or people like Ron Barber and Gabby Giffords who went into politics and became elected officials, these are all public servants who really have given up so much of themselves to be able to help their community. I think that's the real definition of a hero. You know, I'm much more comfortable with the word role model, or if you know any Yiddish, mensch, instead of hero. Because I did something that I think I would hope anyone in the same situation would have done. But I don't consider myself a hero. I think I have a long way to go before I earn that title.
You've had some daunting things even happen since then. I mean, you've publicly been an advocate for gay rights. You're also a Latina, which sometimes in Arizona can be a little bit controversial in and of itself. What are the biggest challenges you faced since you've become a public figure?
You know, in my book, I talk about the process of becoming the youngest gay elected official in the country and one of the youngest Latino elected officials in the country. You know, it's not been easy, but for me, it's always been about overcoming challenges, especially those personal ones that I have, to be able to give back to my community. I think when you are in this kind of position, you face a lot of scrutiny. You know, I think I'm the only school board member who has ever had international press coverage when they're running for office. So it puts you under a microscope, but that's why I think it's important for me to continue to do a good job. You know, it's not enough to just get elected. It's not enough to just be someone who's vocal about certain issues. You need to be able to do this and to do it effectively, which is why every time that I work on something for the school board, I try and make sure that I reach out to as many people as possible, get as much information, because I don't want to fall victim to my own hype. I don't want to fall victim to my own perception of what people expect of me, because the standards that I set for myself are oftentimes so much higher than any expectations anyone can set for me. So I'm always trying to exceed expectations by doing a good job, which is why when I get asked, what are you doing next? What are you going to run for next? I say, before I even get to that level, I need to make sure that I've done a good job in the position that I'm in. And the only way to do that is to actively work and to actually do that thing before thinking of what's my next step.
Well, Daniel, that leads into this, my final question, which is it daunting to think you've got a lot to live up to, considering you have so much of your life ahead of you, we hope, and you've already been through so much?
It's terrifying to think at times that at the age of 23, I've already done some of the things that I've done. So it's kind of, the expectations are high, but the expectations that I have of myself are probably higher than most people. So I'm always going to be very critical and very harsh on myself because I know I'm able to accomplish so much. But moving forward, especially with the release of this book, I hope that I'm able to be a good role model, especially for young Latinos and young gay people. Because when we were writing this book, it was one of those things of, I spoke to different groups around the country. I was traveling, and I would always hear the same thing. While January the 8th was the reason why we found out who you were, there's so many more interesting things about you, Daniel, that we wish you could share your story with our students or with our nieces or our nephews or just with our children. It's really, for me, about being a good role model, and everything else is kind of secondary to that because I just want to do the best job that I can.
Daniel Hernandez, former intern for Gabrielle Giffords, who helped save her life. We spoke in February about his book, They Call Me a Hero. Still to come on this special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now, should people keep trying to change Phoenix to make it friendlier to the so-called creative class, or should we just leave it alone? We'll hear from Robert Pala and Taz Lumens. Stay tuned.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ 91.5 FM. Coming up at 1 o'clock, stay with us for BBC NewsHour, and the world comes your way at 2.
KJZZ keeps you connected.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
Stay connected to our community and the world throughout the middle of the day. Get news, conversations, and stories that will satisfy your curiosity with Here and Now, NewsHour, and The World from KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by SMOCA, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, where modern design, original handicrafts, and architecturally inspired gifts provide an artistic twist for holiday giving in the museum store at SMOCA.
Sunny skies around the state right now. It's 35 degrees in Flagstaff, 56 in Tucson. It's 11:22 at KJZZ.
It's a special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. In the spring, we heard from a couple of commentators for a segment we called Phoenix, Love It or Leave It, which led to some debates on air and in social media. What is Phoenix supposed to be? A high-density metropolis for the creative class with a multitude of transit options, or a car-dominated community that mysteriously thins out when our run of 100-degree days starts too early, like in May? And if the valley isn't what you want, should you keep fighting or say eh and move to some other probably cooler place? Taz Lumens is a sustainability and architecture journalist who put Phoenix in her rearview mirror and moved to Portland, Oregon.
The other day, I went to the grocery store about three times because I kept forgetting things. But it was easy because the grocery store is just a few minutes walk away from my studio apartment in the southeast neighborhood of Hawthorne in Portland, Oregon. For a while now, I've been wanting to live a car-free lifestyle, but I just wasn't able to shake owning a car while I lived in Phoenix. Even though I lived in a fairly urban part of central Phoenix with a grocery store within a 10-minute walk, I still needed my car to visit my parents in Chandler because otherwise it would take me 3 hours to get there on the bus. Because of the way the city is built and the lack of a robust transit system, I found that not having a car in Phoenix is a pursuit of a martyr rather than a viable lifestyle. But when I decided to move to Portland last October, I knew that I could finally get rid of my car and live the lifestyle that I had been longing for, on foot, on my bike, and on transit. A study by the RCLCO, a land use economics firm, shows that 77% of millennials plan to live in urban areas because they want to be close to work, entertainment, public transit, and other amenities. And the AARP recently reported that as baby boomers move into retirement age and older, driving will continue to steadily decline as an option for getting around. The question for Phoenix, a city that has been very much shaped by the preference for driving, is whether it will be able to evolve as preferences evolve. Like others who share my values, I worked towards an affirmative answer to that question, seeing only a small incremental change happen. When I visited Portland last fall, I saw that so much of what I advocated for already exists. The striking difference between Portland's evolution towards sustainability and Phoenix's stagnation was hard to ignore. All this made me ask the question, why don't I live in Portland? Was my life about advocating for basic bike, ped, and transit infrastructure in a culture that showed no signs of valuing those things? Or could my talents and skills be taken to the next level in an environment where that basic infrastructure was already in place? Where the culture was in sync on the things that matter to me, like urban vibrancy, community-oriented design, and sustainable transportation. I chose to explore the latter and made a move to Portland in early February.
Former Phoenician Taz Lumens.
I think if we could invent a weather machine that would give it the climate of Eugene, Oregon, I would stay there forever. It was the heat that drove us away. I couldn't take it anymore. I got kidney stones. I got all kinds of problems because of that heat. And it just got to the point where the older I got, the less I could take it. And I never stopped sweating.
That's Lori Notaro, a 30-year Phoenix resident who lives now in Portland, Oregon. She shared a list of a few things that, in her opinion, make Phoenix better than Portland.
Phoenix is better because of the lard in refried beans, because moss does not grow inside of your car. Phoenix is better because getting a suspicious mole sliced off your nose is way cooler than spending 20 minutes a day in front of a fake sun called a happy light.
Lori Notaro currently lives in Portland, but still visits the Valley often and keeps the 480 area code on her cell phone. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. Longtime journalist and KJZZ commentator Robert Pala says there's nothing wrong with trying to change Phoenix, but you might want to keep your expectations low.
One of the things I've noticed about Phoenix is that the boring people never leave. It's the creative people, the ones whose art galleries I've admired, in whose playhouses I've seen worthy productions, whose restaurants I make return visits to, who are likely to throw up their hands in defeat and blow town. They head for Seattle or San Francisco or Long Island, where they won't have to explain to their friends the difference between a gallery and a museum, where they can walk to a neighborhood coffee shop without passing out from heat exhaustion, where their creative energies are accepted and fueled by a community of savvy city dwellers. I think the problem is not that creatives can't make something of this place. What I've noticed is that they so often want to make Phoenix into some other place. And listen to me, I've been here for a half century. The Valley of the Sun is never, ever going to be Seattle or Los Angeles or even Pittsburgh. We are primarily a place that attracts folks who don't like winter weather, people who care about affordable real estate and convenient shopping, and not so much about culture and cafe society. And here's what those of us who do care about art spaces and coffee houses and cool buildings keep overlooking. There's nothing wrong with a city that doesn't care about these very things. Being popular with the creative class is not the sole measure of a city's value. Sometimes a city is worthwhile to the people who live in it expressly because it has a lot of parking lots and a Walgreens every half mile. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that creative types should give up and go away, leaving Phoenix to its NASCAR events and its endless parade of home and garden expos. It's just that those of us who stick around would do well to face the facts. No matter how many neat little boutiques we open or how many arts districts we launch, we're always going to be swimming against a tide. We're always going to have to explain what a loft apartment is to nice people who can find Chase Field blindfolded but don't know what the Heard Museum is. This is their town, and we're just trying to read Proust in it. If this genuinely troubles you, then moving to a world-class city is your best choice, because Phoenix is willing to settle for a warm, dry February and year-round hiking. Artists and culinary geniuses and curators are welcome here, but it's the bankers and clerks and cake pan salesmen who stay. Phoenix is about convenience, not coolness. It's a big city built for people who would never dream of putting lipstick on a pig.
Commentator Robert Pala. To broaden the discussion, in October we invited Lindsay Kincaid, an experimental urbanist and strategic futurist, and Sarah Sullivan, a theater artist and educator, to join us. They were taking part in an event called Why Young Leaders Are Breaking Up with Phoenix. Lindsay, let me start with you. So young leaders are breaking up with Phoenix? And if so, what are we going to do to stem that tide?
So I would maybe reframe the question a little bit and say that instead of thinking of people breaking up with Phoenix, instead I would prefer to think of us as launching those people out into the wider world. So I would argue that Taz Lumens did not necessarily break up with Phoenix, but instead was launched out into the world, into the next phase of her career, which is actually really exciting. So that's how I would respond to kind of that frame.
Okay. Sarah, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that there are certainly artists who are leaving Phoenix, and this idea that there are places where art is happening and you have to go to the Portlands or the Seattles or the Chicagos or the LAs to do that. But I also, as an artist here, I feel like I have done some of the most exciting artistic projects of my career in Phoenix.
And why do you think that's the case? Is there something brewing here that people don't know enough about?
Absolutely. I think that there are so many opportunities in a place like Phoenix where we don't necessarily have an established cultural tone for the city. I think that emerging arts leaders, people like me, I started a theater company with a colleague 2 years ago. We have this opportunity to really be at the table and a part of setting that tone for really interesting, dynamic art and investing people in that from the ground up.
Lindsay, I want to go for some positives as far as what people can do, but also let's be realistic about the perception, at least, which mm-hmm. is that Phoenix is a place where it's tough to do these things. It's tough to get the greater populace to realize what's going on. As a person who's lived in other places, why do you think that premise seems to be the case here?
I guess I don't know too many people who kind of hold that as the way of seeing Phoenix.
Okay.
I recognize that it's out there. I think that it might be an old vision of Phoenix that hasn't been updated in a little while. A lot of my work is really focused on trying to reach out to new people who are coming to Phoenix all the time, who frankly have been a part of very established art communities elsewhere in the country, who have all the credentials we could ever hope to find in arts leaders, but who haven't plugged in yet because it's a little bit hard to find one's way.
Mm.
A lot of the work that I'm doing is welcoming people to Phoenix because I think it's really easy to notice people leaving, but it's much harder to go out and meet newcomers who are here but who are not yet plugged in. So I feel like we need to rally our energy and our love for Phoenix and go out and welcome these new people to come in and plug them in quickly before we miss the opportunity to get them to stay.
What do you think the best ways of getting people to be plugged in and be excited about it?
So Jim McPherson and I are doing a whole bunch of different projects around town. We are testing different ways of reaching out to people because not everybody wants to be invited in the same way. I mean, we could put a banner at the airport and say, come on in, but people want to engage with the arts in different ways at different times based on their own life, mm-hmm. and we need to meet people where they are in their own life. So we're reaching out in all different kinds of forums. We've produced a website called welcometophoenix.us. We have a zine that we're giving out to people that lists all the different downtown organizations because a lot of people don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
And Jim can't personally have coffee with every single person who moves to Phoenix, much as we might like that to happen. So we're trying to take a lot of the kind of infrastructure that already exists here and share it in a more open way, a more open-sourced way, too.
Sarah, do you feel like you've gotten support here and that people are excited about what you're doing?
I absolutely do. But I think something that's really unique and really important is that a lot of the support that we've gotten has been in the community and not necessarily from arts organizations. Although we get a lot of support from other artists in the community, I think key to my success has been partnering with community members and building art that's really rooted in our community that we live in. And I think that has gotten people really excited and feeling like they have a stake in arts in Phoenix.
That does seem like a unique quality. Is there something that when people think about perhaps Phoenix doesn't have the tradition of some of the other bigger cities, in many ways, is that a plus for an arts community, this idea that it's more of a tabula rasa, sort of?
Definitely.
Okay.
I think that there's a great opportunity for people to feel like they're being invited to be a part of creating art and viewing art, who might not feel that they have that invitation to more traditional types of art.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts on that?
I also think that nationally, internationally, the way that the art world has been moving now for 50 years, the way that mobile technology is affecting the way people participate, the next generation wants to participate. They want to collaborate. They want to be together. They want to be mobile connected. Mm-hmm. Like, they want to be able to find things quickly and easily through a good user experience, which part of the user experience in Phoenix that is so hard is that when you walk down the street, you don't necessarily bump into the stuff that is cool. But I think the next generation that frankly is going to be the next group of leaders of the arts in Phoenix, we're all collaborating with each other, we're helping each other, we're lifting each other up to provide the kind of user experience to our city that people will really plug in and stay and put down roots and realize that the weather here is dreamy. It's a totally affordable place to buy a house. It's flat as a pancake and easy to ride a bike. Like, the quality of life here is actually very good. And knitting together all of the diverse resources that we have is part of the hard part. And so I feel like technology and participation of citizens is kind of the only way to do it. Like, a top-down way of organizing wouldn't work here anyway. Mm. So we get to make a big leap because of the mobile technology that we have. We get to just make a big leap and plug into what's coming next in 2014 and have thousands of people collaborating to make the community better.
Absolutely. I think we can really be a part of building each other's audiences. That as a theater artist, it's really important to me to go to gallery openings and dance performances. And I hope that those people will come and see the shows that we put on stage as well.
Well, Sarah, do you think we define art in too narrow a sense and we're looking too much in the traditional senses of art and people are not quite as open yet, or they don't know quite enough about what else is going on in the community?
I think that there are a lot of ways to be an artist and to be involved in arts. Rising Youth Theater, the company that I co-founded, we do art that is really rooted in our community, and we partner with community organizations to create original plays. And one of the things that's really important to us is putting people who don't identify as artists, who don't identify as performers, on stage with professional actors, people who do have that training and that experience. And that creates a really powerful opportunity for theater.
Mm-hmm. Lindsay, I have to come back to this. As someone who's lived here most of my life, which I'm in my 40s, folks, so it's been a while, this idea that Phoenix has been such a place known for sprawl. And you talk about some of the younger artists coming in who want to collaborate, who want to be closer together. Perhaps they're using public transit, they're riding their bikes. Is this going to be a cultural shift? And if so, how long should we wait for a cultural shift? Because as we've heard the Robert Pala commentary, Taz Lumen's left, even if people coming, there are also people who are leaving. Should there be an amount of time where people say, I've got to achieve these goals, or we just all have to dig in together and not put little timelines on these things?
So I will tell you that the sketchbook that I carry with me every day in downtown Phoenix is a long and wide sketchbook because we sketch the timeline. We sketch the timeline of what are we doing in the next 30 days, what are we doing in the next 6 months, what are we doing in 5 years, in 10 years, in 50 years. So if we are not constantly thinking about those many futures, we're never going to be able to get to a really big, audacious goal. And frankly, I have a pretty big, audacious goal, and a lot of other people in downtown do too. So we are constantly thinking about the time, but also acting in the present. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not just about a bunch of brainstorming of wild ideas and wagging a finger and saying Phoenix should do XYZ. It's instead saying, like, what can we do right now? Can we go on a bike ride today, tomorrow, the next day that also accomplishes some other goal? And how can we knit together all these different projects?
Should the goal be, though, to, as you're doing, welcoming new folks, how much of the goal should be to convince people who've been here already that great things are happening?
So I would say that most of my work is not about convincing anybody of anything,
okay,
but instead just inviting everyone to come participate in the most fun, most exciting, most affordable projects that we could possibly do. Like, I think it's less about convincing and more about inviting. Like, if we had asked people what they wanted back in the day, they would have said they wanted a faster horse. They wouldn't have realized they might want a car instead. So it's not about convincing people to get a faster horse. It's about just building the car and then inviting people to come into whatever this new experience is that we're creating. So I appreciate that there are critics. I appreciate that a lot of people are not into downtown Phoenix or haven't been downtown in a while. I would just invite all of those people, come to First Friday, come to Third Friday, come back downtown if it's been a while since you gave it a try. Mm-hmm. I recently went out to Mesa to meet with some people who are doing very exciting work out there and updated them about what's going on downtown. And they said, you know, actually, it's been a little while since we've been. And so they came to the next First Friday and said, oh my goodness, we had no idea. So I guess I would just say to all those people, you might have an oh my goodness, I had no idea kind of moment, but you can't just expect to walk down the street and bump into it. You need to plug into some of the, you know, marketing materials that are out there explaining what the different events are and go to a planned event, because there are a lot of professional people, great artists, great event planners who are planning beautiful experiences for you in downtown Phoenix. And it's easy to ride the light rail. It's easy to walk. It's easy to ride a bike. It's easy to get around safely. And if you want to go out to dinner and have a beverage, it's there are many safe ways to get where you're going.
Now, Sarah Lindsay makes this sound really great and easy. What do you think?
I think it's both great and easy and really challenging. Okay. There are so many things. I completely agree with you that it is not about convincing, it's about inviting, that so many of the people who think that they want something would be surprised to find how much of that already exists and is available to them in the city of Phoenix. But I do think changing that narrative and changing how we perceive Phoenix and how we think about art programming in Phoenix, both within our local community and what we think is available, and nationally, what people think about when they think of Phoenix as a cultural community, because we are a cultural community. There's an incredible amount of amazing art happening here that's really dynamic and different and exciting. And I think one of the things we can do as artists is to help push towards changing that narrative by writing about the great work we're doing, by continuing to spread that message, by inviting people into our theaters who might not already feel invited to come into a theater and be a part of a program like that.
That was a discussion we had in October on Here and Now with Sarah Sullivan, a theater artist and educator, and Lindsay Kincaid, an experimental urbanist and strategic futurist. Still to come on this special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now, we'll find out why investigative reporter Jana Boomersbach has turned to writing kids' books. Stay tuned.
Good morning. You're listening to Here and Now on KJZZ.
In Qatar, many parents are wary of sending children, especially girls, overseas for college.
When it came to my daughters, I was worried, where will I send them? I can't send them to the States.
So the country imported American colleges and perhaps some unexpected democratic American ideas. That story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts this afternoon at 3 on KJZZ. What's the best way to spread holiday cheer and make your accountant smile? Donate your unwanted vehicle to KJZZ in support of the programs you enjoy and receive a tax benefit on your 2013 taxes. Donating is secure and easy at cars.kjzz.org.
KJZZ is supported by the Arizona Community Foundation's Pecos Center for Business Philanthropy, planning and managing corporate philanthropy programs for Arizona businesses. azfoundation.org/PecosCenter.
It's 11:42 at KJZZ.
This is a special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. You just heard about what Phoenix could or should be doing to attract younger, more artistic people to the city. Earlier this month, the Phoenix New Times explored whether Phoenix is actually a cool place to live. I spoke with managing editor Amy Silverman, who also wrote the cover story. We've asked if Phoenix is a malleable, newer place where newcomers can comfortably try to change what they don't like. But we've avoided the most direct question, one that's pretty relevant to a lot of the population. Is Phoenix cool? Phoenix New Times managing editor Amy Silverman wrote the paper's cover story on Phoenix's Cool Index, and she joins me now. Hi, Amy. Good morning.
Hey, Steve.
So, is Phoenix cool? Please say yes.
Ooh, it's such a tough question. I think there's an even more important question that I realized when I was reporting the story, which is, do we have to ask the question anymore? Hmm. I think we're really to the point where we don't, where people feel a lot more confident about living here and confident in what they're doing here, and it doesn't really matter as much.
Okay. Well,
are we cool by a Portland, Oregon standard or a Brooklyn, New York standard? No. But do you care?
Well, I don't. You and I have both spent basically most of our lives here. So for us, I don't know if we even, you know, we were sort of born here, and so we kind of have to feel that, well, whether it's cool or not, we're going to stay here.
Ooh, I couldn't wait to get out at one point.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Okay, at what point?
For a long time, I didn't. I didn't want to be here.
Okay.
And I struggled with it. I've written about it for New Times and other places over the years. You know, it's interesting. I had a conversation a couple weeks ago with a woman named Taz Lumen, who you guys have talked to. And Taz is a really great person. She was an architect here in Phoenix recently. She left for Oregon. And we had a discussion about Phoenix and why she left. And I hung up the phone with her, and I thought, I love it here. I am so happy that I stayed. There is something so freeing and wonderful about, I mean, first of all, you and I are lucky because it's our home, but there's also something wonderful about being in a place that it just doesn't have to try so hard. It doesn't have much to live up to in a really good way. And actually, I would argue that in the last 10 years, we've developed a lot, a whole lot more than we had. And there are a lot more people staying than going, more important people staying than going. And that was really the point of the story that I wrote.
Yeah, the people you profiled, you picked out a dozen people and you went down your list and then they've all stayed. Give people some insight on that. If they haven't read the piece, your cover story in the New Times, were there similar reasons for staying? Were they completely different reasons for staying?
I don't think anybody really gave it much thought because they are all so busy working on their work, on what they're working on here. I mean, Cindy Dash and Greg Esser are a good example. I think that probably 15, 12 years or so ago, they were both really hell-bent on leaving. And then I turned around one day and they had bought the building on Roosevelt Road that became iLounge, that became one of the anchors for Roosevelt Row. And I'm sure they've thought about leaving since, but those two are so busy now. Greg now runs an international artist program at ASU. Cindy is a co-owner of Changing Hands Bookstore. They're getting ready to open a second store in Central Phoenix. She and Greg run Roosevelt Row. And she runs an art boutique as well. I get exhausted just thinking about what they do. Those two don't have time to read Richard Florida's work. They don't have time to worry about whether or not the city is cool. They've made it into what they want it to be. That's what they're doing. That's what the people on this list of 12 have been busy doing.
Are these folks that had similar attitudes? Perhaps they were not as angst-ridden as some of us and just decided, hey, this is where I'm at, so I am going to shape it into what works for me?
No, I think some are angst-ridden, and I asked several, almost all of them, if they thought Phoenix was cool or not, and the answers were really across the board. Some of them thought that Phoenix had arrived. Some of them thought that Phoenix was always cool and never had anything to worry about. And quite a few said, no, not really, not yet.
Well, how do you define cool, if we come back to that?
That's a really good question. It's that thing that you can't nail to the wall that makes you know that you want to be in a place. You know, Richard Florida, who's this kind of urban planning guru who New Times brought out to Phoenix 10 years ago, the city hired him. He wrote a book about what he calls the creative class. And he argued that you really needed to do whatever you could to draw the creative class to your inner city or your city was going to fail. He said, if you have to ask if you're cool or not, you're definitely not cool.
Okay. Now, for creatives, coming back to the creative class concept, how many of them do you think have come because Phoenix is so malleable, as I mentioned? They can make it into what they want to be. There is less. You know, we've had fights with people about whether there's enough history in Phoenix or not, but clearly it doesn't have as much as Philadelphia or Boston or something like that.
I do think that people come here to do that, but I think more than that, there are people like Wayne Rainey, who runs Mon Orchid, a gallery on Roosevelt Row, who've been here all their lives, or Sloan McFarland, who co-owns the buildings for Lux and Pane Bianco are, and he has this Your Land project farther south. They've been here all along, and they really see how far the city has come and what they have already been able to do with it and what they can do moving forward. I think it's an insider's game to a large extent. I think it's probably hard to look from the outside and figure it out. I thought that about Phoenix forever, though, that it's a very hard city to figure out when you land here.
Yeah, and again, you've been here for a long time. I want to come back to when you were tempted to leave. Was that a young woman's idea, thinking she needs to get away from her family, or did you really just not want to be here anymore?
Oh, I think that was at birth.
Okay.
from the time I was little, my parents would stick the black and white TV in my room on Saturday nights and have dinner parties, and I'd watch Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart and think, I want to wear a knit cap and throw it in the air, and I want to live in a big high rise, and even All in the Family looked good to me. I just wanted to be somewhere else. I think growing up a liberal Jew in the Arcadia neighborhood in the 1980s was really not the best bet. And so I did. I left several times in my early 20s. Never meant to come back, but I did.
Amy, let's come back quickly to the insider's game concept. With so many people who are transplants, it seems like that would have changed, this idea that it's still an insider's game to some extent. Is it a different kind of insider's game? It's no longer the folks like Eugene Pulliam. It's more of the folks in the creative class and the artist level?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Wayne Rainey made this argument, I think, in my story that, you know, Phoenix is one of the few places where you don't need to have a famous name in order to make it big. And so I don't think it has anything to do with having money or having a name or any kind of reputation, anything like that. I think it's being able to realize what the city's potential is. I think you and I can look at it and know what it used to be and what it is now and what it can become. And someone coming in, it just might be a little bit harder to figure that out. I mean, yeah, there are plots of land that are empty. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what is really needed culturally, I think it's hard to come in and just figure that out.
Amy, less than a minute or so, I wonder, with Phoenix's history, quirky or not, some restaurants that people love, some places that people used to hang out, can a place be cool and combine some of that history, or does it have to sort of give itself over to the new generation?
Oh, I think that the history is a big part of what makes Phoenix cool if it is. Our Best of Phoenix issue this year for New Times was a vintage theme. And so we went back and looked at a lot of old businesses that are still here, places like Durant's, that really give the city its character and its color and complement the new places coming in. You can't have one without the other. You have to celebrate the old and bring in the new, and adaptive reuse is really what has made Phoenix so much better in the last 10 years, and Kimber Lanning and others deserve a lot of credit for that.
Amy Silverman is managing editor of the Phoenix New Times. She wrote the paper's most recent cover story on Phoenix's Cool Index. Amy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
I'm Steve Goldstein. We close this special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now with journalist Jana Boomersbach. She was an award-winning investigative reporter for the Phoenix New Times, a regular columnist for Phoenix Magazine, and she wrote the authoritative story of one of Arizona's crime legends in the book The Trunk Murderess, Winnie Ruth Judd. Boomersbach's latest book is quite a departure. It's for kids, and it's called A Squirrel Story. We spoke in October.
This is a serious story because this is a true story based on something my parents witnessed in their backyard in Hankinson, North Dakota in 2007, which turned out to be the last year of my dad's life. And they watched the squirrel family move into a birdhouse, which, first of all, never happens. Squirrels don't live in birdhouses. And then have this whole angst about getting their children out of the birdhouse and all, what they were doing and the whole thing. And there was a cat that was running around being dangerous. And my parents just found this to be pretty amazing. And at the very end, there's a climax to this story where the mother squirrel has to have real tough love to get her last kid out of that birdhouse. My mother called me and said, I have never seen anything like this in my entire life. This was the most amazing thing I've ever seen an animal do, and you've got to write a book about this. And so I said, oh, sure. You're like, what do you say? You say, yes. So, I would just kind of pass it off, and mother would say, where's my squirrel book? And I, no matter what I was doing, I might have been writing a Pulitzer Prize-winning story, and she wanted to know where her squirrel book was, So finally, I met this publisher, Linda Radke, from Five Star Publications, the day of our centennial on February 14th, 2012, on the Capitol lawn. And she said to me, have you ever wanted to write a children's book? And I said, well, my mother wants me to write one. And she said, well, let's think about it. So I called her up, and we talked about this squirrel, and she thought it was a cute story, and da-da-da, we started in. And so then it was, well, how in the world do you write a children's book? I mean, I'm used to writing about blood and guts and gore and dirty politics and, despicable politicians and bad people and stuff. And all of a sudden, now I'm supposed to totally change the dial and write about squirrels, of which I knew nothing about squirrels. I had this one scene. I had the scene my mother told me about, and that was, she thought that was an entire book. Well, that's like one page of a book, right?
Right.
So I did what I normally do as a journalist. I started researching squirrels, and you can't believe the research into squirrels.
But you've done so much hardcore research, investigative reporting at the highest levels. So how much did you really need to know about squirrels to write a children's book?
A lot, because, you know, the standard for writing a children's book is a lot higher, Steve, than it is when you write for adults. I mean, this is, it really is. I mean, here you've got these little minds, and you can't talk down to them. You can't try to shine them on. You have to be honest with them. You have to be clear. You have to be precise. You have to tell them information that's accurate. You have to, must be accurate. I mean, there is absolutely nowhere for inaccuracy for children, because you don't want those little minds to be absorbing the bad information. So the standards are extremely high, and, you know, you're aware of everything that you're writing that, you know, I've got a little mind is going to, like, listen to this and maybe, you know, remember this. So I've got to be really careful. So it's like stepping up in your career to be, okay, now a new level of total preciseness and accuracy.
Let's go back to Linda Radke, your publisher, for a second.
Yeah.
How much massaging did she have to do with you in order to have you write in this way?
This is a really smart woman, and she leaves no grass grow under her feet, right? When she decides she wants something, she really goes for it. And she was so comforting, and I kept saying, I don't know that I can write this. She, you can write this book. I know you can write this book. She was very, very hand-holding with me. And she said, let me send you a contract. And she says, I said, well, I'm working on this other book right now, and I got to finish that, and then I'll write you this children's book. Okay, well, I'll send you a little contract, and we'll get everything all set up. She sends me a contract with a deadline, a July deadline. This is March 15th. She gives me like 3 months, 4 months to write this book. And it's sort of like, oh my God, I've got to really, this is really serious.
Tell us how strange that is.
That's very strange. I mean, normally, usually you're fighting to get a contract, right? You're begging publishers to take you on. You are, you know, writing big proposals and doing all this stuff, and you're, you know, tearing your hair out, and you're going... This was the opposite way. This was, she saw a story she wanted, she saw a writer she wanted, and she went after it. And I'm very grateful that she did.
When people hear Jana Boomerswamp writing a kid's book that her mom couldn't even get her to write, did you have this brewing inside you, or is this sort of like, okay, I need to pivot a little bit to expand my career? Give us the insight.
It was really Mother saying, when I said to Mother, I met this woman who's a children's publisher. She says, oh, good, now you can write my squirrel's book. I mean, she instantly, like, jumped on this, right? Now, I think my mother's been pretty happy with my career most of my life, and she's been, you know, loved, and she's been here for several awards and that kind of thing, which is nice. But I don't think I've ever done anything, Steve, that made her as happy as this squirrel book.
So you're not the next Madonna, then? You're not going to have... Okay. Because there are only celebrities writing all these children's books now. That's a trend.
I know. And, you know, and I like that people try to write children's books. I mean, some of them write good ones and some write bad ones. But and the good ones, the bad ones, they go by the wayside really fast, right? But the good ones, they last and last. And children like to hear them, and they like to read them, and they like to look at the pictures.
Can you remember how many words the Winnie Ruth Judd book had?
Oh, a couple, probably 200,000, 300,000
words. And how many in a squirrel story?
Probably 300, 400
words. Which was harder?
The squirrel was harder. I really did sweat over this book. I mean, I really did, like, and we had lots of nice editing help so that they'd say, maybe this word would be better and more precise, and da-da-da-da, and, you know, that.
Journalist and now children's book author Jana Boomersbach. That's all for today's special holiday edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. To hear our previous editions, please go online to kjzz.org or try our new KJZZ app. Thanks very much to Nick Blumberg and Mark Brody for their help during 2013. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Steve Goldstein. Happy holidays and Happy New Year.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, celebrating Subaru's sixth annual Share the Love event, which has contributed $35 million to charity. Shop Subaru.com.
Good morning. Here and Now from NPR continues next on KJZZ. That's followed at 1 by BBC NewsHour.
This is KJZZ. Your news and information station is now on your phone with the newly available KJZZ mobile app. You can read the latest headlines, get podcasts of KJZZ shows, and stream KJZZ all from your smartphone. Your cell phone keeps you connected to friends, family, and social media, and now you can stay connected to KJZZ. Download the app for free at the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Look for sunshine around the valley today. We should see a high near 70 degrees. It'll be clear overnight with a low in the mid-40s. More sunshine on Thursday with a high of 70. Sunny again on Friday, 71 degrees for the high. We may see some clouds moving in Friday night. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD, a service of the Maricopa Community Colleges. We're on the web at KJZZ.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at KJZZ Phoenix. Sunshine around the state right now. It's 35 degrees in Flat.